Welcome back, everyone, to MX Asian American. Today we have Wendy. Do you want to introduce yourself first to the listeners?
Sure, I'd love to. So my name is Wendy. I am born and raised in San Francisco, and I would like to say what I would most identify myself as is founder of Building Education. It is a nonprofit organization that serves to build safe schools in developing countries to end the cycle of extreme poverty and then spark a legacy of change. But some more information about myself that I can go through briefly. I have also competed in beauty pageants. I have the title of Miss Nepal Global Citizen 2021. Studied aviation, which you all will hear about later on in this podcast. And I don't necessarily want to say that I love to travel, but I've lived all across, the world for about 6, 7 years. So I traveled all across Asia, Europe, and Africa. And I lived in Spain for a good amount of time. So just kind of back, I'm actually in Spain right now, revisiting one of the places that I lived for about a year. And I'm excited to share about all of that with you all.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Super multifaceted person here. We'll just start with way back when. Could you tell us a little bit about young Wendy? How was she like? And where did you grow up? Things like that.
Sure, I would love to. So I'm Chinese American and I was born and raised in San Francisco. So my parents were immigrants to San Francisco from China. And the funny thing is the way that I view myself, because I think that we view ourselves completely different from how other people view us. And growing up, I always thought I was a very shy and timid kid, and I was somewhat like the youngest female on my father's side out of all my cousins. So I definitely was a little bit of center of attention, and I like that. But I still viewed myself as shy and quiet and not quite so popular, but just kind of followed. And the funny thing is, my grandma tells me about a story of when I was a child, and she said, even as a little child, I was always very brave. And she remembers the time when I was just 3 years old, and I insisted on going onto the big kid slide instead of the little kid slide. And she would, try to persuade me not to go on the big slide. And she said, what if you fall over and die? And I would say something along the lines of like, well, if I die, then I die, but I'm going on the slide. And funny thing is, that's very much my personality now. Like when I'm set on a goal, when I'm set on doing something, no matter how dangerous it might seem to other people, I'm very persistent on executing and doing what I want to do in life. So I guess that's a little bit about Wendy when she was a child.
Oh, I love that story. It kind of shows like maybe when you were a child, you maybe didn't understand the consequences, but now, even though you do understand it, you still persist within, like, in the face of fear or any obstacles, things like that.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Because I think that in life we only have one life to live. And I always, in the times when I've come across the most intimidating situations in my life, I've always thought, okay, I can either choose to live in fear or I can choose to live my life the way that I want to live it. And I've never been one to live in fear. I mean, I've never been one to make the choice to live in fear. And the truth is, it's only about 90% of the time that or 90% of the time our fears don't actually come true, right? That's like the statistic. So I think, yeah, I kind of live by doing the things that I desire in life, living life to the fullest in the route that seems truest to myself rather than sitting in that fear and not doing the things that I want to do.
Yeah, no, that's very admirable. And like, I feel like I myself still struggle to do that. I feel like a lot of people do. And it's definitely a journey. And you've shared before in some of your posts that you lost your mother when you were 8 years old. And I imagine like as a child, that would be really hard to grasp what was going on. How do you remember that time of your life, and how did you like struggle through it, or
Absolutely. So, I mean, I was 8 years old when my mother passed, and she was sick for a really long time. She passed from lung cancer. And the funny thing, she never smoked, but she was sick for a long time, right? So at the age of like 7, 8 years old, I watched her get sick. I watched her lose her hair. I watched her really lose her energy and not be able to do much in life, and then end up in a hospital bed, barely being able to breathe. So I think as a child, it's a very traumatic experience. But when you're a child at 7, 8 years old, it's very hard to comprehend your feelings. So you don't really know what it is you're feeling. It essentially you're somewhat kind of numb. But now being an adult, and I really believe in self-development and really learning about my feelings, my traumas, how to process them correctly. And I recognize the experiences that I go through now, and I can relate and say, okay, this is probably what I experienced when I was a child, and this is why it's coming up. I imagine that I had a lot of anxiety of not knowing what was going to happen next, whether my mother was going to live or to not live. But ultimately, when she passed, what that really taught me, because I really do believe that everything in life teaches you something. So her death taught me to essentially comprehend life and death and contemplate life and death at a very young age. And what I realized, and still realize to this day, is that life is short, and you never know when someone is gonna go or how long they'll live. But the most important thing is the impact that your life leaves on other people. And even more than that is, you want to make sure that you leave the planet and humanity as a whole a better place than you found it. The second thing that I think I learned, I'm going to share a little bit about a story, what my father did when my mother was really sick. And I don't think I really understood it at the time, but what he taught had a huge gesture. And the fact that I still remember it today leaves a really significant mark in my life. But I remember she was really sick. And one thing that my father did is he went to, so she was in the hospital in Chinatown, San Francisco, and he went to the fish store at the corner. And this fish store was like selling fish and turtles and all these things to consume, right? They were going to be killed and then they would be eaten. And I remember him buying the turtles, and there was like two or three turtles, and he brought them to Golden Gate Park, and he freed them. He let them live. And essentially what I learned in that moment was that if you could save a life, then it is your job and your duty to do it. And I'm sure it had something to relate to, my mother's current situation, and probably some religious or Buddhist affiliation as well. But I think I learned so much in that short time, and that short time was that life is short, and make an impact the way that you can and leave the world a better place than you found it, especially with the people that you love the most. And that if you could save a life, that you just go and you do it. If you can help someone, make sure that you do it. Yeah. And I think that
That's beautiful.
thank you. I think it's made a huge mark on my life now. Yeah, I think that's essentially the values that I live by to this day.
Yeah, no, that's beautiful. And I can totally see that kind of manifesting self happening with through building education, what you've started, right? But we'll get to that soon. And so heading into college or high school, do you have any idea of what you wanted to do or pursue?
So the funny thing is, building education was kind of built on somewhat of my high school years. So a lot of what I share about in my past is, I always talk about going from tragedy to purpose, or pain to purpose, or catastrophe to catalyst. And the catastrophe is always, losing my mother at a young age, and the catalyst being the one thing that forced me to do or pushed me to do something greater in life. And so I would say that like my mother's passing really was challenging in a sense that I might have not known how it was going to affect me, but it definitely affected me in a sense that I didn't have that extra parental guidance in my life. And so when you talk about high school, I went from being basically a straight A student. I was on the volleyball team, and I was also in gymnastics. I competed in gymnastics for a little bit, to all of a sudden realizing that, you know what? Even though I'm doing really well in school, I don't necessarily feel like I'm getting the attention and the guidance that I would like. And so I started to rebel. So in the time of high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do. I rebelled in a sense that I was almost a high school dropout. And that's what my whole story is about. I transferred to two different high schools before I ended up graduating. And a lot of it was because it wasn't cry for help. I wanted attention, and it was the attention that I didn't get when I was doing well. And so this is where the story begins for me, because I saw the trajectory of my life and where it was going by almost becoming a dropout in high school and seeing, like, okay, this is where my life is going, and what is the future that lays ahead of me? And so it was in those moments that I realized the only thing that would save me is actually education. And so I continued. I went back to get my degree, obviously, in high school. And also, most importantly, I decided to get my bachelor's, and I went to college. I went to a university, and that is what changed my life. Education essentially became that extra parent that I needed to instill the discipline and structure that I needed. And I didn't know what I wanted to become at all. But I think that is the whole story of building education, seeing how education, regardless of where you are in the world, can be that structure and discipline that any person needs, can be that opportunity to life. That really made me see how this could help other people in developing countries as well.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you said about how education can be a sort of second parent or even third parent to some kids who may not have parental guidance, even though they have parents. And that was like true for me as well. Like growing up in high school, some of my biggest mentors and supports were my teachers. And they were the reason why I went to university and pursued what I pursued. So once you got into university, how did you decide to study aviation science and like flight and things like that?
So actually, this was during the time when I was still like rebelling, and I started to I've always been very involved in self-development without really realizing it. Later on, I did self-development a little bit more formally, but I started to ask myself questions like, okay, if this is what's going on in my life and this is what I'm experiencing, why am I going through this? Why am I choosing these things? What is it that's going on inside that is causing me to rebel? And I really, like, I learned early on that number one, I was seeking attention and love, and I realized that nobody was going to save me but myself. That was number one. And the second thing that I realized was that I didn't have the self-worth and the empowerment that I was seeking for. I didn't feel like my life was worth living, to be completely honest. And I know that had a lot to do with my mother's passing and not feeling enough. So I thought, okay, well, what can I do to fix this? If I don't feel like my life is worth living, if I feel like not enough, then what can I do to instill the self-confidence that I needed? And so I was like, okay, what can I think of that's impossible, that I've never, that to me seems impossible? What can I do that will make me feel empowered? And what have I, like, not seen very many females do? And so I was like, you know, I don't think that I know of any females that can fly planes. I don't know. I don't think that I don't think that it's possible for myself to learn how to fly a plane. So why don't I see if I can prove myself wrong? So I went into aviation because I wanted to learn to fly, and I wanted to myself that I could do something that I thought I could never do, which is learn to fly a plane. And so essentially I did it, and I fell in love with aviation. I definitely did. I was very, I honestly have a very obsessive personality, which I learned to use as a strength, right? So I become obsessed with what it is that I'm passionate about, and I'm committed, and I proved my and I proved myself wrong, and I learned to fly planes. So that was how I essentially got into it.
No, that's amazing. And I feel like you have such a so self-reflective, even from a young age, like analytical as well, almost as if you're like always analyzing yourself.
Too much. I'm very self-critical. So, I learned that because I lost my mother at a very young age, you know, because like you can never even imagine like those 2 years of, you know, someone who is basically your god or your caretaker, like being sick, right? And trying to comprehend that, you know, and becoming upset over that issue, you know. So I think I got it from that. It's definitely built my character to who I am today.
Yeah, and you're always like trying to find like what's wrong, or like if there's a problem that needs to be fixed, right?
And how to solve it.
So you go into aviation. What was the experience like? Did you face any like male pilots who were like, ha ha, what are you doing here, kind of? Or was it more like a like welcoming environment?
So the funny thing is I actually didn't end up becoming like an airline pilot of any sort. I realized I didn't want to fly planes as a profession for the rest of my life. You know, I was like, you know, I love flying. I enjoy flying, but I don't necessarily want to be an airline pilot. It's no offense to any pilot out there, but it's kind of like flying a glorified bus, right? And I was like, that's not that much more than that. Don't get me wrong. Men in general in the aviation industry are quite good, except that I had like one weather teacher, you know, like one teacher in one of my weather classes, right? Who was like, oh, you can something like that. On a news channel. And I was like, okay, you know, but that was fine. Just as a pilot, you have to learn basically everything, right? Like weather, mechanics of aerodynamics. But I felt like it was a pretty supportive environment. I feel like there was some pretty male drama. But I mean, those, a lot of careers are, right? But what kind of like influenced me to then switch careers was because I actually took self-development for that a little bit more of my life. And I took this one self-development program that really asked me to explore what I was passionate about. And I was like, passion? Like, I never thought about this. What passion, right? Because as Asian, you know, Asian American, or even Asian, like, you don't, your parents aren't never tell you, like, hey, think about what your hobbies and passions are. It's like, you know, working and make lots of money. Right? So I was like, passion. And so I was in a leadership program, and it came to like our community service area. And they were like, oh, figure out what you're passionate about and volunteer in it. And I was like, I have no idea what that is. But the first thing that kind of came to my mind was women empowerment, obviously, because, you know, I was a female pilot, had a pilot for the FPPF. And I was like, okay, well, I want to empower other women, because I felt empowered at that time. And the second thing is, I had never traveled internationally, but I don't know what it was that kind of stuck in my mind, but I've always been fascinated with media, even at a very young age. So I was like, okay, maybe I'll do one of the part of media. And I ended up volunteering at a girls' rights event for about, you know, a few weeks. And it just changed everything about myself and the way that I saw the world and the way that I saw myself in the world. And I guess I'll go into the story because, you know, going into India, and at the time I was living in LA, I had two cars, I had, you know, an apartment to myself, I had plenty of like brand name, like purses and shoes and all these things, right? Going into a girls' orphanage in India, and you meet these girls that are all like super young, under the age of 14 years old, and they're so happy, they're nice and they're sweet and they're so giving. Right? You're like, oh, I wonder why these girls are in this orphanage. I don't understand why they're here. But these girls really changed my life because they were so sweet when I first met them, super disciplined. They woke up at the crack of dawn, you know, they would cook breakfast for themselves. You know, they all had this schedule that they lived by. They went to school, they studied really hard, they came back, they, you know, did their homework and spent all day on it. And India education is like super competitive, right? Because it's such a populated country. And in order to really kind of be able to get a secure job, like education is definitely something that is very competitive. They would wash their own clothes. You know, the older ones would take care of the younger ones. The youngest was probably about 4 years old, Sneha. And I remember walking to the corner store with them. And what happened was every single one of them told me their stories. And many of them suffered from human trafficking. One of the girls came from a sex brothel. Like just horrendous stories. One girl was raped by her father every single day and went through 6 abortions before she ran away. And yet they were so giving and loving, and they were the most incredible human beings that you could ever experience. And I was like, okay, why is it that these girls have gone through so much, like severe homelessness, living in a gutter, and they can come back and be so loving and so giving and so kind? And for myself, you know, I came from a first world country, a developed country, and I lost my mom, and I really had this kind of bad attitude, feeling like the world still owed me something. And yet these girls were so talented, and they were so loving, and they were so giving, and like the worst, I mean, they came from the worst backgrounds and just unheard of. And yet they wanted to give me every single one of their possessions. And it was in that moment that I realized that happiness and giving and loving, all of those things are a choice, and that I no longer had to live that way anymore. And I realized, in addition to that, that there was so much more in the world that I had to learn. There was so much more out there. So I went back to LA, and it was still in aviation at the time. That year, I brought in like $5 million for my company. It was like one of my first years in the company. And, you know, I didn't feel any fulfillment in hitting that goal. But I went back and I started to fundraise for the girls in the girls' orphanage in India. And just hitting like $6,000, like being able to raise $6,000 in a month, it felt so fulfilling. And I was so happy. And I realized another thing, like, you know, if I can bring in $5 million in one company, I can definitely do it in another. But the pivotal moment for me was really when my CEO took me aside, and he, you know, he had dinner with me and all that stuff. And he kind of asked me, like, you know, what he asked me many times, actually. He's like, what position do you want? Like, where do you see yourself in the company in the future? Right? Like, how much money do you want to make? And those were all questions that I could not answer. I was like, oh my God, I can't, like, who am I, like, am I going to be like that person or that person? Or like, and I was just like, you know, I just don't, it's not like it was all things that it wasn't something that I wanted. And the thing was, like, to me, I don't think it's ever been about money. And it's more about, and I guess it goes back to, like, you know, the impact that we make in life. You know, it's to me, it wasn't about money. Money is important in life. It really is important, right? Because it drives, like, it's fuel for everything that we do. It's, and money is not a bad thing. It's a great, beautiful thing if you know how to utilize it in a way that is beneficial for yourself and for everyone else, right? So money is a great thing. It's a beautiful thing. It's a thing that fuels any one of your hobbies, any one of your passion projects, any impact that you want to make in this world. But I knew that it wasn't my number one thing. My number one thing would always be giving back and leaving the world a better place than I found it.
Wow. I feel like I just have to sit with that, and especially your story about volunteering in India and talking to these girls. Thank you so much, Wendy, for sharing that story, and that definitely touched me as well. So then, and even your meeting with your supervisor, and he was telling you where you see yourself in the company, and you're like, I don't really see myself in the company. So after this, like, whole life-changing experience, what did you pivot towards? Was this like the seedling that eventually fueled you to start building education?
Yeah, so it's like it wasn't really like so how building education started was kind of accidental. And I think I'll go back to the beginning. So it was that moment, you know, after my CEO took me aside that I was like, okay, this isn't it. You know, and I told him, I was like, you know what? I'm just gonna spend a year, I'm gonna take a gap year, I'm gonna travel for 1 year. I'm gonna travel through Asia, you know, Asia and Africa. I said Asia and Africa, that's what I said. Europe was never in part of the story. But that 1 year turned into 6 years, and it was kind of accidental. Honestly, if it weren't for COVID, I might not even be back. But I started to volunteer internationally. So the first place that I volunteered at in Thailand, and I taught English for a little bit of time in a very rural village of Thailand. But during my first trip to India, like right after India, I went to Nepal. And I never, honestly speaking, I was so like geographically illiterate. Like I didn't know
Me too.
before, because in the I hate to blame it on the education system, but it's so true. We're not taught these things in the US. Like we're so not aware of anything that happens outside of the world, like outside of the US. And it's really a shame. But I started to learn that because when I started traveling to India, and then afterwards I went to Nepal, I started meeting people from different countries, and I was like, wow, like these people are speaking about world cultures and religions and politics. And I'm like, how come I don't know any of this? And I was like, because I'm not exposed to any of it in the US. And so that was a big thing for me too, because I love to learn and I love to explore. And I didn't really know that I was such a lifelong learner, but I was very fascinated with world culture, politics, religion, number one. And I mean, traveling, I've, you know, stayed and lived in monasteries in Thailand. I've stayed in monasteries in Nepal. I've been to like and ashrams in India. Like I've stayed in all of them because personally, I love studying religions. Not that I'm personally religious, I would say I'm spiritual. But anyways, going back, I went to Nepal. I didn't know anything about Nepal. I was a very naive traveler, and I was really fascinated with how closely like the people kind of looked Chinese. And getting into a taxi, I was like, wow, this guy looks like he could be my father. And I never even knew this country because it was right next to China. But well, I often got lost when I was in Nepal. And people of Nepal were so gracious. They were so loving. They were so caring. And no matter where I went, they were always very willing to help me. I remember this taxi drove me around for 2 hours until I found my hostel one time. Right. So just the most amazing, incredible, gracious, giving, kind people, and not in the world, but just kind people, right? Because I think there's kind people everywhere. But that always stuck with me. And it was fascinating to learn about the Himalayas and that Everest was in Nepal, but yet we don't know Nepal, but we know Everest. When I was actually in Thailand teaching English in a very rural village, there was an earthquake that hit Nepal and damaged 9,000 schools, 750,000 homes, killed 9,000 people. And I remember hearing that, and I just felt so called to go and volunteer in Nepal in earthquake disaster relief. And so I think that's how it all started, because I was like, you know what? I'm going to go and I'm going to volunteer. So within the first 3 months, I then, take a flight to Nepal, and I volunteered in earthquake disaster relief. And it was like the destruction was horrendous. Like it was so horrendous. You could see like lives were just completely destroyed, right? Like buildings were completely crushed. People couldn't go to school. They couldn't go to work, you know? And essentially a lot of the work that I did at the time was cleaning up rubble of buildings and homes that had completely been destroyed and toppled over, right? And then on top of that, like I was also building homes that have been destroyed. Working in displacement camps were so disgusting because people essentially had to be removed from, you know, their broken houses and buildings, and they were put into like these small areas that were dirt and put up in these tents, and they had these fake toilets, and essentially the poop would just go into the dirt, and so they were essentially living in their feces. And we were also building temporary schools made out of bamboo because we hadn't been able to demolish the schools that were damaged. So I think that was really what sparked it for me, like first building that very first temporary school made out of bamboo, because the people, I mean, the girls, even though the school wasn't built yet, they would come to watch us, and they would come in their uniforms. And for the first time, I saw people smile. And that was when I realized that education not only is an equalizer and not only is the discipline and structure you need in life, but also it's hope, right? It's the opportunity to a new life, you know, when people have nothing. And that was the first time that I saw, you know, anyone smile since the earthquake. And now a lot has changed, right? But that was how it started. That was how it started. So after I finished my volunteering with the earthquake, there's still so much damage, right? But my volunteer time was just over because I had signed up for like an X amount of time. So I went to also like do some trekking and explore the country a little bit. And I met this man essentially who told me about this school that was damaged in a slum area right outside of Pokhara. Pokhara is kind of a developed city. So I started off working somewhat in a more developed area that was a slum village. And he asked me to come and visit and see the school. And so I did. And, you know, when I first got to the village, it was a slum village. The kids were slum kids. They were running around barefoot. And so I knew that the first thing that we needed to do was to build a school because we needed the kids to go somewhere. And there was about 50 kids at the time. So we started off with that. We built the very first school. And then after that, you know, I remember walking down the street to school one day, and there was a man lying on the ground with his guts hanging out, and he was dead. And when I went to the school, I found out that it was our student's uncle, Robbie's uncle. And so that was the moment that I realized that, wow, like the people that were dying in this village, there were like 1 to 2 deaths every single month. These were not just random people. These were, you know, people that were connected to our students, who were our kids, which was our people. And so I was like, okay, well, what do we need to do about this situation? And what people told me in the village was that there was no clean water on site. And so then we built the very first water system. We brought in water, provided clean water to over 110 homes, including the school, 110 households. And then since then, I've heard of very little deaths. Then after that, we brought in electricity, which enabled the kids to have Wi-Fi. We then went to the local municipality, the government essentially, and we petitioned to have the roads repaved. And so, you know, the first 3 or 4 years before COVID happened, that project was really challenging. But essentially what I saw, you know, by the time that COVID almost hit, to be honest, was that this entire community transformed before my eyes. And it became a sustainable community. The kids who were once slum kids could speak English to me. You know, they could tell me what their dreams were, that they wanted to become doctors, that they wanted to become engineers. They were more empowered decision makers. The mothers were able to find employment. And so essentially that was our very first village that we completed, our very first project. And essentially that's what we do. We bring this model that we created and we scale it to other rural villages with the completion of a school, a water system, clean energy and hydroponic system. So yeah, it transformed before our eyes and it became a sustainable community. And so that was how building education started. And once COVID hit, I was actually trying to summit this mountain in the Himalayas, which I failed because there was a huge snowstorm. And I had this epiphany. I was like, you know what? It's been 6 years of traveling. I think I'm going to, and there's so many schools that need help. I'm going to move back to the States and I'm going to ramp up fundraising efforts. And I'm going to then scale this to other areas. And so I guess that was how building education started. It wasn't something that was intentional. It was just a huge, huge need. There was a huge need that had to happen. And to be honest, with the first school, that man, the man, Tej BK, he asked me for like 6 months, like messaged me nonstop, please help us build this school. And I was like, no, 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 no. You got the I'm a traveler. I don't have money. I'm not trying to do this right now. So 6 months of persistence, and I finally just gave it. So again, like, yes, traveling, giving back is something that I love to do, but I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to start this nonprofit organization. It was like, there was a huge need and people were asking me, and I was like, there's no way. I don't know who I am. I'm just a small, like, you know. And then building education started. And sometimes it's just about following what the universe gives you and receiving it. And the journey never been easy, but it's something that I love and I'm very passionate about. So it's never actually really felt that hard. And honestly, it's helped me to grow in ways that are completely unimaginable. I wouldn't be the person I am today if it weren't for the organization. And I credit that to the organization because it's forced me to become a better person, because I knew that in order for me to grow this, I needed to grow and I needed to mature and become better. So very grateful. But yeah, it wasn't like, I was like, I'm going to start a nonprofit. It was more like things were pushed upon me and I just was like, okay, fine.
No, I think that story is amazing. And I was gonna say, I feel like the universe was calling you to do something because you were at that place at the time that you were needed, right? And I imagine like building these spaces, an entire village and community with your own two hands, right? Definitely left such a deep impact in you. So I know you've already like fundraised and built. The mission is 1,000. So how do you see kind of the trajectory going, or any future plans or goals for building education?
Yes, absolutely. So the biggest thing is, like, we definitely plan to expand to other developing Asian countries. So just speaking in terms of primary school education, meaning like, you know, elementary up to fifth grade, not even secondary. But statistics show that there's approximately 60 million children that are out of school for primary school education. So 13 million belong in Asia, and then 33.8 million belong in sub-Saharan Africa. So my dream has always been to expand. Our commitment is 1,000 schools in Nepal, just because 4,000, like 9,000 were damaged, only 4,000 have been rebuilt. So there's still 5,000 that need to be rebuilt. Now it's a little bit messy because some schools, like two schools, might have been merged into one, but there's still so much help that we need. Like, we get so many proposals every single day. And right now we're on our fourth and fifth school and village. Because every school takes a lot of time, and it takes a lot of time staying in the community to kind of rebuild it and to make it more sustainable. So our commitment is 1,000 in Nepal. However, we would still love to expand to other developing countries or Asian countries. So we've gotten proposals from Laos, from the Philippines. So those are the areas that we're looking in, and then as well as Vietnam, and then definitely sub-Saharan Africa as well in the future. But, you know, going into any country, it takes a lot of time to really learn the dynamics of how a country functions, and then building connections. I would say the most important thing is really building the connections in one country. Like, it's only until now that I really feel like we have a really strong connection with the local government. And great talent in Nepal. So it's taken us some time, but we really have been able to build strong, strong connections in Nepal. So all of that takes time, and learning about the dynamics of how a country does business takes time as well. So eventually we want to expand to other areas other than just Nepal. And the second thing is, in terms of fundraising, so we do fundraising in many different ways. We have our major donors, we have you know, corporate sponsorships, and we also do monthly donations as well as fundraising events. So right now, most of our fundraising is done in San Francisco or Silicon Valley area. And we also expanded to LA last year. So this year we're planning to expand to Seattle, but essentially what we would like to do is expand to 12 major cities up to fundraise in the US. So 12 major cities in the US. So right now we're in San Francisco, we're in LA, we're planning to expand to Seattle this year. And then after that, we'll probably do New York City and Washington, DC, and 12 major cities all across the US.
Awesome. Really exciting and sounds like a lot of work, but very fulfilling work. And after all of this and learning that you do so many things, how do you take care of yourself? Because you're on vacation right now.
I'm really bad at taking care of myself because even though I'm on vacation, well, I'm learning, right? And again, it comes back to self-development. And at the end of the day, like currently, because where the organization is, I am the organization. So if I don't take care of my mental health, if I don't take care of my physical health, like mentally, physically, emotionally, that affects the organization in general. So I make self-care a top priority, not saying that I'm great at it yet, because it takes time and practice and consistency. But a big thing for me is getting up really early in the morning, always getting up, getting my workout in. Because in general, I'm an anxious person and I get obsessed with things that I do. But if I wake up at 5 a.m. and, you know, get my coffee in and get to the gym and get my workout in by 6 a.m., I know that the rest of the day is going to be like set off right. So as long as I do that one thing and I have that one thing done, then I know the rest of everything else that will just fall into place and that I can conquer and overcome anything that comes my way. So I'll start with that first, really waking up at 5 a.m., getting my workout in at 6. And I'm still working on making it consistent, to be honest, because life is ebbs and flows. But I really believe that, you know, in order to be very successful at something, I was a gymnast and I always wanted to be in the Olympics when I was really young. But that's how I want to perform. I want to perform like an Olympian. And when I can perform like an Olympian, that's how you can become a champion. And to me, becoming a champion when it comes to nonprofit is just having a very successful organization that can build our 1,000 schools, that can help millions of kids all over the world. So yeah, starting with that first, physical fitness and doing what I say I'm going to do.
Well, thank you so much, Wendy, for coming on the show and giving this so much wisdom to all of us. Where can listeners find you if they want to connect with you and learn more about Building Education?
Absolutely. So Building Education's Instagram is at Building Education. The website is www.bebuildingeducation.org. If you were to find it on Facebook, it would be the same thing on LinkedIn. And then for my own personal, you can find me on Instagram at it's Wendy Hsu. So ITS Wendy Hsu. Same thing. Facebook is Wendy Hsu. LinkedIn is Wendy Hsu.
Awesome. Thank you so much again, Wendy.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Karen. It's been wonderful to share about my passions and I'm excited for all the great connections I'll make from this.